Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, the gun business goes to the White House, Freakonomics goes to the Hall of Fame, and one of our reporters goes to the gym. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday. It's the 9th of January. Good as always to have you with us. And you know, you can go one of two ways with the gun debate in this country. You can go passionate, the way New York Governor Andrew Cuomo did in proposing an assault weapons ban in his State of the State speech earlier today.
It's simple. No one hunts with an assault rifle. No one needs 10 bullets to kill a deer.
Or you can go low-key and bureaucratic, as Vice President Joe Biden did in a meeting with gun control advocates also today.
And as the president said, if our actions result in only saving one life, they're worth taking. But I'm convinced we can affect the well-being of millions of Americans and take thousands of people out of harm's way.
Recommendations from the vice president's gun violence working group are due, as you might remember, on the president's desk by the end of this month. Tomorrow, Mr. Biden hears from industry on the topic. The focus is on gun control policy. But Marketplace's David Gura reports even the gun business gets plenty political.
Richard Feldman accepted the vice president's invitation. He'll have a seat at the table. He heads the Independent Firearm Owners Association, and Feldman hopes the debate will be different this time around.
If we want to have this national collective food fight that we usually engage in with sloganeering and bumper stickers on both sides, then nothing serious is going to come of it.
But Adam Winkler, a law professor at UCLA, says other groups weren't as enthusiastic about being invited.
I think it can be delicate politics. I think the reason why the NRA is generally reluctant to engage with the Obama administration is because they don't want to be the ones who are viewed to be responsible for the problem.
And that's a concern some businesses share. Paul Argenti teaches corporate communications at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. He says that if you accept an offer like this one to talk about the problem of gun violence, that says something.
I think it does place some responsibility on your shoulders, and you're admitting to something.
Walmart is the world's biggest retailer, and it sells a lot of guns and ammunition. Its executives didn't exactly hightail it from Bentonville, Arkansas to Washington. First, there were scheduling conflicts. Then, in a statement, a Walmart spokesman said the company underestimated the expectation to attend the meeting. Paul Argenti at the Tuck School calls that bogus.
I mean, when the vice president or president calls, I think you can be more flexible in terms of your schedule.
Walmart moved some things around. The company's spokesman says it's sending an appropriate representative to participate tomorrow. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
A word about the political future of the American economy before we move on now. Along with the news today that Secretary of Labor Hilda Solis is stepping down, there have been widespread reports that President Obama is set to name White House Chief of Staff Jack Lew to replace Tim Geithner as Secretary of the Treasury, maybe as soon as tomorrow. There will be ample opportunity to talk about the policy implications of that nomination, which we will in due course. Right now, though, we're going to talk about handwriting. Mr. Lew's signature, to be precise, because it is a doozy, a series of loops that have been likened to a slinky that has lost its spring. I mention it because it's entirely possible that he is going to be signing our money pretty soon. If history is any guide, though, he's going to get some handwriting lessons first. Last spring, I asked Tim Geithner about how his signature changed after it started to matter just a little bit more.
Well, I think on the dollar bill, you know, I had to write something that where people could read my name.
Is that what it was?
That's the rationale.
Did the lawyers come to you and say...
I didn't try for elegance. I just tried for clarity.
Because Mrs. Quigley, my first grade handwriting teacher, she would have given me the big, like, you know, F on that one.
Well, I took handwriting in third grade in India, in Delhi, New Delhi, India, and so I did not probably get the best instruction in handwriting.
You can check out the Secretary's changing orthography on our website. It is pretty remarkable, I have to tell you. It's marketplace.org. Wall Street today, nice enough, if not actually remarkable. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. ours isn't the only presidential inauguration on the books this month, you know. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez was set to be sworn in tomorrow, except he can't make it because he is widely rumored to be in Cuba dealing with complications from cancer surgery. Today, the Venezuelan Supreme Court postponed the festivities, and Chavez has picked a successor just in case he's not going to be around for too much longer. It does appear, perhaps, that Chavez era is winding down. Marketplace's Scott Tong has this look at a socialist strongman and his economic agenda.
Chavez economics starts with Chavez ideology. He took office in 1999, pledging to fight corruption and share the wealth. I reached publisher and consultant Robert Batome in Caracas by cell phone.
People tend to vote with their pocketbooks, even here. And so Chavez was offering a change. He was going to get the economy growing again. He was going to throw the bastards out. He has tremendous personal appeal.
Early on, Chavez took control of the biggest piece of the economy, oil. Foreign companies like Exxon operated there, but Batome says Chavez was unsatisfied with the royalty payment negotiated in a contract, so he doubled it.
Then he doubled it again. He didn't like the tax scale, and then finally he decided he didn't like my partner, so he told them that from now on, instead of being majority owners and operators, you can be minority partner if you like, but I'm going to run the show.
Speaking of show, Chavez hosted his own talk show every Sunday, as in him talking. Former Venezuelan Trade Minister Moises Naim is now with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
He once decided to fire all of the top management of the National Oil Company. In other instances of his show, he would nationalize a bank or the electricity company.
Now, what you and I consider independent economic data is hard to come by in Venezuela. But there's no question Chavez spent money on the poor, on their health care, appliances, subsidized gas, and he drove out lots of foreign companies. Today, Pomona College historian Miguel Tinker Salas says Venezuela is a hybrid economy, part socialist, part consumption capitalist.
You can have on the one hand a discourse about socialism, but the malls are full. Venezuela is the highest consumer of Scotch whiskey per capita in the world.
Chavez also sent money to his neighbors, often in the form of cheap energy. Some were friends of the revolution, like Cuba. Others, marriages of political convenience. Here's Michael Shifter of the Inter-American Dialogue.
So if there are votes in organizations that come up about Venezuela, those countries are more likely to be influenced if they get a good deal on oil to vote with Venezuela as opposed to against Venezuela.
It's been a potent fusion of power, ideology, and economic leverage, says Shifter, which raises the question, is this how every strongman economy tends to work?
I don't think it necessarily has to go this way. I think you see other examples. Bolivia, we have Evo Morales, who is a close ally of Hugo Chavez, but the Bolivian economy is much better managed than the Venezuelan economy.
Today, the country faces double-digit inflation, billions of dollars in debt, and is highly dependent on the oil sector. When prices fall, the economy goes with it. And yet, the Chavez socialist experiment continues. Why? Oil money to bankroll it, says Moises Naim at Carnegie.
That allows you to then experiment and provides you a cushion to cover for your mistakes. The oil curse allows for sustained bad ideas to linger over time.
On his show late last year, Chavez picked a successor in case he can't go on. So whenever the era ends, what happens next? Historian Miguel Tinker Salas.
I don't think there's any going back. Venezuela has changed. People who have been empowered are not going to retreat into the margins anymore. Venezuela will not change whether Chavez is there or not.
But others say if and when Chavez leaves the scene, his magic does too, which could leave the question open, whether the Hugo Chavez strongman economic model outlives him. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner. He is the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. Dubner, how are you?
Kai, I'm great. Thank you.
Happy New Year and all that.
thank you to you as well. Today, yeah. Big news, the Baseball Hall of Fame voting was announced. Yeah. I don't know if you caught that.
Of course I did.
And a grand total of 0 people were elected to the Hall of Fame this
year.
Now,
were you surprised?
I was a little bit surprised. It's the first time since 1996. In fact, you know, all the talk was about the fact that because the steroid age is happening now, and guys like Clemens and Bonds who deserve to be in but won't be elected
Wait a minute. Are we going to have that conversation? You think they deserve to be in? All right, that's a whole other
segment. No, I'm not having that conversation. That's another conversation. Right. But the argument was that because those guys are not going to get elected, that it would free up a little bit more space potentially. But as it turns out, nobody got in. And I got to tell you. This is what I'm here to talk about today. This is bad news. If you get nominated to a Hall of Fame and don't get in, not only do you not get in, but I hate to tell you this, Kai, you actually might die a little bit sooner.
Ow, because why? What? Why?
Well, there's a growing body of research that looks at the relationship between what we call status generally and life expectancy. Okay, so the economist David Becker, he looked at Hall of Fame data, Baseball Hall of Fame, and he found that while a player who gets elected to the Hall of Fame doesn't necessarily outlive the average baseball player, he does live a couple years longer than a player who gets nominated for the Hall of Fame, but year after year gets rejected. Mm. Here's David Becker.
So this seems to suggest to us that it's really the story that getting close but not winning is what's really bad for health, which we think is potentially a really profound point about the nature of status competition more broadly in our society.
So actually, it's not an honor just to be nominated, right?
That's exactly right, which is appropriate to talk about since tomorrow is the nominations for the Academy Awards will be announced. And there's also an Oscar effect. Donald Redelmeyer, who's a medical professor at the University of Toronto, he has done research and now argues that Oscar winners outlive their peers. And here's his best guess as to why that is.
Once you really got an uncontestable measure of your own peer approval, all of the subsequent, nasty reviews or setbacks or rejections just do not seem nearly as aggravating. Yeah. They sort of roll off your back, and in turn, that makes you much more resilient.
Absolutely.
Now, Kai, let me say this. This longevity research is pretty complex. Some researchers are unpersuaded, but the more fields you look at, the more plausible it seems that a status boost is good for your health, and perhaps more convincingly, that getting close to the mountaintop but never quite reaching it, that's a real setback. The economist Andrew Oswald looked at this phenomenon among 50 years worth of Nobel Prize winners.
All right.
We do find that if you're lucky enough to win the Nobel Prize, you can expect about 18 months more of life.
Well, okay, but hold on. I mean, that's great, 18 more months. But when you win the Nobel Prize, you get like $1 million. How do you know it's not just being rich makes you live longer?
Yeah, that's a good question. So that's one of the first problems that a researcher has in this kind of research, which is to isolate a particular effect, in this case status, and isolate that from other factors like money. So they use a mathematical model that will control for other differences. And in this case, Oswald found that the money was not a factor in the Nobel winner's longevity. It was, he says, the winning itself.
A nominee for the Nobel Prize looks virtually identical to someone who actually wins the Nobel Prize. The real difference is simply one of them gets the telephone call from Stockholm and the other doesn't.
Well, I will speak only for myself here, Dubner. I am not going to win a Nobel Prize or get into the Hall of Fame or win an Oscar, right?
Hold out hope. Never say never, Kai. Yeah, you're right. Most of us will. That's not going to happen. We did, therefore, go looking for something that might help anybody if they want to live a little bit longer. And you know what, Kai? We actually found something.
All right, hit me, brother. What do you got?
Annuities. So these are the things that people buy. It's this financial instrument you buy, and it pays off a set amount each year, but only as long as you stay alive. So it's like a longevity lotto, right? And research shows that people who buy annuities tend to live longer, and not just because they're the kind of people that have the money to buy annuities to start with. It's apparently that little extra incentive of the annuity payout that keeps people going. So, you know, maybe those Hall of Fame losers want to stock up on the annuities this week.
Any little bit helps, I guess. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks very much, Guy.
Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace is co-produced by WNYC and is supported by Reputation.com, helping make professionals and businesses look their best in search results and online review sites. Learn more at Reputation.com.
Coming up in just a minute, you know, sometimes a little nagging, it just doesn't hurt.
Man is a social animal. And because we're a social animal, we like to do things in groups. And especially when you're trying to achieve things. You know, you really want to achieve things with other people.
Weight loss in the social media age. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow bounced back 61 points today. That's almost a half percent. 13,390 was the resting point. The Nasdaq recovered 14 points, about 0.4% there. The final number, 3,105, 3,105. The S&P 500 tacked on 3 points. That's a quarter percent, 1,461 at the bell. Boeing shares stabilized in the wake of recent turbulence for its new Dreamliner jet. Executives of some of the airlines now flying the 787 dismissed the glitches as, quote, teething troubles. And Boeing led the Dow's rebound with a 3.5% gain today. And unlike a little WD-40 to lubricate the markets, the household products maker reported new and improved sales in the Americas and Europe. WD-40 stock spurted 10% higher today. Is Apple going after the lower-end market? Perhaps its stock sliced off 1.5% today after the Wall Street Journal reported a cheaper iPhone may be in the works. Who knows? Bond prices edged higher, nudging the yield on 10-year T-notes down to 1.86%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Labor Department releases its monthly job openings and labor turnover survey. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is scheduled to meet with Afghan President Hamid Karzai. And on January 10, 1971, the anthology series Masterpiece Theater hit public TV. It's now called Masterpiece, and it's presenting a drama you may have heard of, Downton Abbey. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, so we are still, what, three-something months from tax day, right? But there are millions of people out there who are already set to drop off or stick in the mail their 1040s. They are just that organized and eager, not to mention, to get their refunds. Sad to say, though, they are going to have to wait just a little bit because in yet another trickle-down from the fiscal you-know-what, the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, says it's delaying the start of tax filing season by about a week. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
Think of the IRS as a huge ship slogging through a sea of red tape. The captain sends out an order, turn the ship around, we're headed for an iceberg, or maybe a fiscal cliff. It's going to take some time for the good ship IRS to plot a course that includes 2012 tax changes in the fiscal cliff deal.
The IRS is a very inefficient, bureaucratic, and slow-to-move operation.
That's Scott Hodge. He heads the Tax Foundation, a Washington think tank. But Hodge says as fun as it is to bash the IRS, it's not entirely to blame. Hodge says the White House and Congress dragged out the fiscal cliff debate, making the IRS scramble now to reprogram computers and print forms. Len Berman is an economist and tax expert at Syracuse University. He says there's a good reason the IRS is taking some extra time.
The people at the IRS are very risk-averse because if they make a mistake, there's hell to pay.
So the IRS says it won't start accepting tax returns until January 30th, 8 days later than usual. John Hewitt is founder of Liberty Tax Preparers. He says tax refunds will now be delayed by about 8 days. That could hurt filers who diverted money to holiday expenses, counting on their refunds to cover their bills.
So they'll have more penalties in terms of bad checks, late rent, late automobile payments, et cetera, et cetera.
Because even if the IRS gives itself an extension, we still have to pay on time. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There will be, it turns out, no AIG lawsuits over its government bailout. The company's board of directors said this afternoon, thanks but no thanks. It's going to pass on joining former CEO Hank Greenberg's $25 billion suit against the federal government. But memories of other bailouts do still linger. Commentator Robert Reich says the future of the banking industry is on his wish list for the new year.
Okay, here's my prediction for 2013. This is the year we break up Wall Street's biggest banks. Why do I think so? Well, first, they're far bigger than they were 4 years ago when they were considered too big to fail. The five largest now have almost 44% of all U.S. bank deposits. That's up from 37% in 2007, just before the crash. A decade ago, they had just 28%. The biggest banks keep getting bigger because they can borrow more cheaply than smaller banks. That's because investors believe the government will bail them out if they get into trouble. So it's dawning on many that there's no alternative but limiting their size and breaking up the biggest. A few months ago, Dan Cerullo, the Fed governor who specializes in bank regulation, proposed capping the size of bank balance sheets. Some former titans of Wall Street are saying much the same thing, even Sandy Weill, who created Citigroup, the nation's second largest bank. And the new Congress may be supportive. The new chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, Texas Republican Jeb Hensarling, has been a strong ally of small banks in their push to rein in their bigger rivals. It's not irrelevant that the Dallas branch of the Federal Reserve, in Hensarling's own home district, has also proposed breaking up the biggest. Meanwhile, over in the Senate, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown is a strong advocate for breaking up the big banks and is now on the Senate Finance Committee. And Elizabeth Warren, scourge of Wall Street, will sit on the Senate Banking Committee. In other words, the timing is right. The oven is ready. All we need is another multi-billion dollar banking loss, like J.P. Morgan Chase's last year, and the biggest banks are cooked.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Beyond Outrage. We're a week and a little bit into 2013, so if you don't mind the prying, how you doing on your resolutions? Those who are trying to lose a couple of pounds are increasingly using technology to do it, fitness tracking devices and apps and those kinds of things. A lot of people, though, are going one step further and just doing it on social media, not Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith, though.
Okay, let's do this.
I am at the gym. Specifically, I'm standing in front of the scale at the gym. It is time for the post-holiday moment of truth.
No.
My only consolation? Nobody else knows what that number is. But these days, a lot of people are actively broadcasting information like that to their social networks. Using data they get from fitness devices, people are letting it all hang out. From details of their daily workouts to the number of calories they burn and even their weight.
So we've kind of turned all of life into AA, is the idea.
James Fowler is a social media expert at the University of San Diego. He says companies have long been mining our data and our social networks for advertising opportunities. But now we're starting to mine our own data and use our social networks for more than socializing.
These effects that we have on one another are so strong. If you have these little nudges that come from your social network, it can be extremely powerful at changing behavior.
It's just a beautiful day out. We'll go past all the construction.
52-year-old Washington, D.C. resident Barbara Talisman is on a lunchtime power walk near the White House.
So across here, so we can stay in the sunshine.
Talisman made a New Year's resolution to lose 20 pounds. So she bought a special armband that measures her skin temperature, heart rate, and sweat levels, and she posts her progress, or lack of progress, to a group of about 10 friends on Facebook.
At New Year's, I said, okay, so you guys are going to be my support group. Yeah, I'm going to post when I'm working out, and you can give me a like or a hey, attaboy or whatever.
In return, Talisman makes sure to encourage her friends' dieting and fitness progress on Facebook, too.
People wearing these devices as badges of honor that they're taking control of their health.
Ivo Stavorek is the co-founder of Body Media, which makes the armband Barbara Talisman wears. It's also featured on the TV show The Biggest Loser. Stavorek says he's been surprised at how eager people are to share their fitness data on social networks.
Losing weight is a lot of hard work. A lot of times it can be a lonely journey. People are using this medium of body data, and they're sharing it amongst themselves and keeping themselves accountable to each other.
Using social networks in this way goes right to the core of who we are, says Deborah Kay, a marketing expert and the author of Red Thread Thinking, a book about innovation.
Man is a social animal. And because we're a social animal, we like to do things in groups. And especially when you're trying to achieve things, you know, you really want to achieve things with other people.
Studies have shown dieting in a group increases the chances of successful weight loss. And dieting with close friends increases those chances even more. It's working for D.C. resident Barbara Talisman. She's lost 2 pounds so far. But there are limits to her social sharing. For instance, she doesn't tell her Facebook friends how much she weighs.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far. I don't think I've actually ever told anybody what the weight was.
Standing on the scale at my gym, I don't think I'm ready to go there either.
Okay. Maybe my shoes weigh a lot.
In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, picking up where our morning show left off, that would be with Monopoly. Our crew picked up the news earlier that Hasbro is going to retire one of its 8 game pieces in Monopoly. That would be, of course, the thimble, the hat, the wheelbarrow, the shoe, the battleship, the race car, the dog, or the iron. They say they're going to decide based on an online poll, so here's my vote. Clearly, the race car stays. It's just cool. Most of the rest are kind of benign, but they got to get rid of that little dog. I mean, come on. Choices for the new pieces, by the way: a cat, a robot, a diamond ring, a guitar, or a helicopter, all of which are kind of goofy. You can vote for the one you want to lose on our Facebook page. All right, we're done. That's it. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow rebounded about 61 points, nearly 0.5%. The NASDAQ rallied 14 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 tacked on 3 points, 0.25%. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for more tomorrow. This is APM.